Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Today I'm speaking with Ted Postel, Professor of Science, Technology and National Security Policy in the Program in Science, Technology and Society at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Dr. Postel has worked with the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment to study methods of basing the MX and later worked as a scientific advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations. After leaving the Pentagon, Dr. Postel helped to build a program at Stanford University to train mid-career scientists to study developments in weapons technology of relevance to defense and arms control policy. He's received numerous awards, including the 2001 Norbert Wiener Award from Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility for uncovering numerous and important false claims about missile defenses. Dr. Ted Postel, welcome to the program.
Well, my pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Now, you are one of the leading people actually in the world who understands, quotes, missile defense. I say missile because I'm Australian. You say missile. And I'd like you to briefly, Dr. Postel, explain to the listening audience, what exactly does missile defense mean, A, and B, how does it fit into America's strategic nuclear policy?
Well, the main missile defense that is the centerpiece of the American missile defense effort is a system they call the ground-based missile defense. And the ground-based missile defense has some very large interceptors. It tries to intercept things at thousands of kilometers range in space.
What's an interceptor first?
Well, the interceptor is a rocket, and the rocket weighs around 50,000 pounds or so, might weigh a little bit more in some circumstances. And it launches what's called a kill vehicle. And the kill vehicle only weighs about 130 pounds. So this 50,000-pound missile can accelerate the kill vehicle to quite a high speed, maybe 8, 9, even 10 or 11 kilometers per second, depending on the situation. And what the kill vehicle does is it's launched to a location in space where it's expected to find a warhead. A warhead would be traveling in space somewhere. You would estimate where it would be when the kill vehicle is able to get there. And basically, you would launch the kill vehicle with this rocket toward this point in space. The kill vehicle has a telescope on it, and it looks for the warhead, and it turns out almost certainly decoys that would accompany the warhead. It tries to select the warhead.
A nuclear warhead, we should emphasize.
A nuclear warhead.
Yes.
And then it tries to make small adjustments to its trajectory so it actually would physically hit the nuclear warhead.
And what would happen to the nuclear bomb then if it was hit by the kill vehicle?
Well, if it was hit, this is a big important caveat, it would essentially atomize the warhead. So hitting the warhead would certainly completely destroy the warhead. The problem the system has is that it's functioning. It functions in the near vacuum of space. It functions at very high altitudes. And in the near vacuum of space, a balloon and a feather and a warhead will all travel together because there's no aerodynamic drag to cause the feather to slow up relative to the warhead, or for that matter, a balloon that looks like the warhead to slow up.
A Mylar balloon.
It could be Mylar, it could be some other kind of material or similar.
Uh-huh.
And now, when the kill vehicle starts looking for the warhead...
With its telescope.
With its telescope, it might start looking 60 seconds before actually trying to hit the warhead.
Uh-huh.
Well, 60 seconds before it tries to hit the warhead, it could be 700 or 800 or 900 kilometers away, because the closing speeds between the kill vehicle and the warhead are in excess of 15 kilometers per second. Even when it's a second away, it's still 15 kilometers from the actual warhead. So there's no time to change its trajectory. So all the trajectory changes have to occur in this long 60-second period.
Mm.
And all the warhead looks like is a point of light, like a star in the sky.
And a feather could look like that, or a Mylar balloon.
Well, the problem is that the Mylar balloon also looks like a star in the sky.
Yeah.
And a lot of other Mylar balloons that might be floating around it, because balloons are light and easy to deploy, could each look like a star.
Which would confuse the kill vehicle and its telescope.
That's right. The kill vehicle really would have no way of telling which point of light is the warhead. And so this system is fundamentally not workable. And unfortunately, the U.S. Missile Defense Agency has claimed otherwise, but they have no scientific evidence that indicates that this is the case.
And Dr. Postel, when the kill vehicle hits the warhead and it atomizes, what happens to the 10 pounds or so of plutonium within the warhead?
Well, that material gets atomized too, and it would really be in the form of literally almost atoms. And at such high altitudes, even though there's very little air drag, atoms would slow up, and they would probably stop, you know, they'd continue on a trajectory of some kind, but they would probably stop at about 40 or 50 kilometers altitude, is my guess, in the upper atmosphere, and it would take them a very long time to find their way to the ground.
So you're not worried about the health implications of that per se?
No, there are other very significant problems, which is, for example, that you probably would never get a chance to intercept the warhead. Other problems are that if you have an adversary who is determined enough, they may launch multiple warheads because of even a small uncertainty in whether or not you might actually hit the warhead, might cause them to launch multiple warheads, and of course, increase the level of damage that would otherwise occur.
So
there are lots of complications here.
Dr. Postel, what about describing MIRVing? Because I don't think many people realize that on one missile can be placed many warheads or hydrogen bombs. What does MIRVing mean? M-I-R-V.
It's an acronym for Multiple Independently Targetable Reentry Vehicles. That's a big set of words, so let me step back and explain it in simple terms. When you think of a rocket carrying a nuclear weapon, most people correctly think of a rocket, and on top of it is a cone-shaped warhead. And now with a big intercontinental ballistic missile, it turns out it's possible to put a small upper rocket stage, doesn't have to be very big, to just and on that little, that upper rocket stage, it's sometimes called a bus.
A bus.
For reasons that will be clear shortly. And on the bus, you could put several warheads.
Up to 8, can't you?
Well, if it's a Trident ballistic missile, it could carry 8.
Yep.
If it's an MX ballistic missile, it could carry up to 12.
Yep.
If it's a Russian SS-18, it could carry 10 or 12 or many more if the Russians choose to put more warheads on them. on the SS-18. And what the bus does, this little rocket stage, is it doesn't have a lot of propulsion, but the rocket basically launches the bus along with the warheads onto a trajectory toward a set of targets.
Mm.
Now, that set of targets could be cities spread over, you know, separated by hundreds of kilometers.
Like Boston, Washington, Baltimore sort of thing?
Correct.
Yeah.
And so although the bus doesn't have a lot of velocity, the velocity it can impart to the warhead is enough to spread the warheads over many hundreds of kilometers against multiple targets.
And is each warhead independently targeted accurately on its target, like Boston?
Right.
How? Right. How do they do that?
Well, if you imagine the bus is headed, let's say, toward New York.
Yep.
The bus can accelerate a little. Well, it can release a warhead toward New York.
Yep.
And then it can accelerate a bit. So it's going a little faster, so the warhead will land a little bit further away and drop a warhead on Washington, and then accelerate a little further and drop a warhead on someplace even further south.
So is this programmed into the warheads and the rocket? Are these?
Well, it's programmed into the bus.
Oh, into the bus.
The bus is upper rocket stage. It has its own guidance system and its own rocket motor. Now, this is not the only... I mean, this is the way... The former Soviet Union and the United States and the French and the British have MIRVed their long-range ballistic missiles. It's not the only way you can do it. You can put small rocket motors on each independent warhead and have them disperse separately. That was not a design choice that was developed by any of these major countries, but, you know, an emerging power from some other country could choose other ways of delivering multiple warheads against, from a single ballistic missile.
Right. And the bus has its passengers, and the passengers
are
the hydrogen bombs. They're hydrogen bombs. Let's then, Dr. Postel, talk about the situation that currently exists between the United States and Russia in terms of the number of hydrogen bombs they have ready to go on, quotes here, trigger alert, and are most of those bombs, hydrogen bombs, in rockets MIRVed? And what, obviously, the logical next question will be, what are the chances that something could happen? But just let's talk about the current situation of targeting, their strategies, the Pentagon strategy for, you know, preemptive first strike against Russia, decapitation of Moscow and the like. Could you just walk us through that in a simplified way, please?
Yeah, well, over the period of the Cold War, both the Soviet Union, and of course it was the Soviet Union then, and the United States built very large and capable land-based long-range missiles. They're called ICBMs, meaning intercontinental ballistic missiles. And these intercontinental ballistic missiles carried multiple warheads, and both sides had... could thereby deliver, let's just take a simple situation for the moment because the exact details are not so important as the concept. Both sides, let's say, had roughly 1,000 missiles each, but they could launch, let's say, 3,000 or 4,000 warheads.
Each.
Because each missile could carry, let's say, 3 or 4 warheads.
Yeah.
So both had more warheads than missiles.
Yeah.
And as a result, if one side attacked the other first, they could try to use this excess in warheads, the extra warheads, to attack each missile on the ground with 2 or 3 warheads.
Before it gets launched.
Yeah, before it's launched.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the real problem is that to catch these missiles on the ground before they're launched requires that you really catch the other side off guard.
Unawares.
Both sides, have early warning systems to tell them that an attack against them is developing. And now, during the period of highest tension during the Cold War, both sides were at least prepared in a technical sense, whether they were prepared in a political and psychological sense, we don't know truly, but they were prepared in a technical sense to launch their ballistic missiles before the other's attack arrived. So let's say the United States tried to attack the Soviet Union with its ballistic missiles. Its ballistic missiles might take 30 minutes to arrive at Soviet ballistic missile silos. The warheads would take that long. The Soviets might launch, they would know about the American launch within minutes of the launch because they have early warning sensors that would tell them. And they could choose to launch their missiles against the United States in response. Now, of course, the net result would be both countries would be completely destroyed. So the sense of this, if it doesn't make sense to your listener, they're thinking. but this was the situation, and it still is the situation today to a large extent. Both sides have substantial nuclear forces that could be used, at least in principle, to attack the nuclear forces of the other. But, of course, the consequences of such an exchange would, of course, result in the destruction of both these countries and probably a very large amount of death and destruction in the rest of the world from secondary effects like radioactive fallout and things of that type.
And nuclear winter. Well, it's a bit of a tenuous situation now, Dr. Postel, isn't it, with the Cold War heating up again. I think that America's being under Cheney, let alone George W. Bush, is being very provocative with Russia introducing countries that were actually part of the Soviet Union into NATO, moving NATO, which is really the United States, right up to the border of Russia, installing missile defense systems in former Soviet nations like Poland and Czechoslovakia, let alone what's just happened in Georgia and Ossetia and Abkhazia. And that so that the Russian leadership is getting quite annoyed and they are starting to fly their intercontinental planes armed with nuclear weapons again, and they haven't been doing that for a long time. Meanwhile, I do believe that America still has a policy, if necessary, which I guess is the Bush doctrine, to preemptively hit Russia if they so decide. So although we would talk about the past being the past in terms of Cold War, as I read it, and I don't know if you agree with me, Dr. Postel, things are actually, I think, more serious now simply because this is happening beneath the radar of the media and people in general. Would that be a fair assessment or not?
Well, I think with some nuances, I basically agree with you. I have actually, when things were not as tense, I was and remain concerned about the situation. First of all, there's always a chance for an accident, and in 1995, my colleagues and I analyzed an accident that occurred where, of all things, a sounding rocket, a rocket that just shoots vertically up into the upper atmosphere for scientific experiments, not going anywhere, it's just basically going straight up, was mistaken for the beginning of an attack by the Russians. And actually, the warning notice went all the way up to Boris Yeltsin, who was then the president. Now, I don't believe, there are people who think otherwise, but I don't believe that the Russians were close to launching their forces. But it's irrelevant whether they were or were not. The point is that for a short interval of time, they thought they might be under attack. And if this had happened at a time where there was a crisis of some kind, a confrontation, where it was ambiguous what was going on between the United States and Russia, this might have resulted in an accident involving the nuclear forces of both the United States and Russia. You don't have minor accidents with forces that have hundreds and thousands of nuclear warheads. An accident would be a catastrophe larger than anything the human race has
annihilation.
Seen.
Yep.
Yeah. So if you ask me, is the probability of such an accident high? I would say no. I think people who deal with these systems, by every measure I can take, both in terms of the Americans I know over the years who have been involved in manning these systems, and the Russians, and I do know Russians who have been involved because I've been in and out of Russia a lot over the years, and I see nothing but careful, sober, responsible people. But that doesn't mean there can't be an accident. And the longer we have these forces poised to shoot at each other, the more of a chance we have of an accident. And an accident would be tremendously serious, tremendously. I just don't even know how to imagine it, and I've thought about nuclear weapons for many years.
What about what happened on 9/11, Dr. Postel? I did read that they got to a high state of alert, DEFCON 2 or 3, from about 6, which means it was really winding down towards possible launch. Do you know anything about what actually happened in the nuclear alert system on 9/11?
No, I actually have never looked into that, but I would guess the state of alert would go up.
We're in the hands of fallible human beings, and I suppose I'm dealing a lot now with global warming and the catastrophic implications of global warming. But Dr. Postel, I keep feeling that we are still on the brink of annihilation every second of every day, either by accident or the Cold War is heating up again, or misinterpretation of other signals, or even a computer error. And I just don't feel that this issue is being given the gravitas that it should be. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I think the chances at any given moment, my own, this is a view I have, which is not more informed than yours, because, I mean, there's just so many guesses involved.
Yep.
I would not claim to be more informed than you on this matter. But my view is that the system is geared not to do anything unless it's really told to do things. But having said that, they're just nobody, including me, who has thought a lot about the potential for accidents, would have guessed that a sounding rocket could have set in motion the whole early warning system of Russia. This is one of the reasons why the analysis my colleagues and I did on this, which incidentally the U.S. government, as far as I could tell, did not do, because I was talking to people in the government afterwards showing our analysis, and they really did not have an internal analysis that looked credible about what happened here. So, which is another reason for concern. People assume the government knows things that they don't know.
Yeah,
it's often the case the government doesn't know things that people on the street know. And we saw this. I mean, the most blatant example of this was Katrina. When Katrina hit New Orleans, all these people in the government, I shouldn't laugh, it was so serious, all these people in the government were sitting around Washington figuring New Orleans had was fine. The president was sitting in Texas. The head of Homeland Security was sitting in a command center. All they had to do was turn on a radio or a television to know, because of what the news would have reported. And it really shows you how people in leadership roles, even with all this modern communication and sensor systems, can have no idea what's going on.
Yep.
It's a very it's a potentially, I mean, you can't invent, you couldn't invent something as bizarre as what happened in Katrina. If you did, people would say, this is not credible.
Yeah, that's...
And so when you transfer, when if you're like me, my sort of profession is centered around these nuclear forces. I take this example of you know, leadership having no idea what they're doing, and I transport it to potentially a nuclear situation. And there are, you know, when you have demonstrations that such events can occur, and that people can be so misinformed who are in leadership roles, you have to accept that anything can happen.
Well, and that leads me to the next question. The Air Force inexplicably and by accident loaded up, I think, 3 nuclear weapons on a plane and flew from Minot Air Force Base to I can't remember where. And those nuclear weapons, hydrogen bombs, were missing for 24 hours before anyone discovered that happened. And then more recently, I think they flew some nuclear weapons parts from America to another country by accident too. So then they had a big investigation led by Gates, who's the Secretary of Defense, about how the Air Force, which is in charge of most of the nuclear weapons that America has, has not maintained its sense of responsibility, I suppose, because the Cold War's over and people aren't nearly as responsible as they once were. So that fits in with what you've just said, that people make mistakes, people take their eyes off the ball, so to speak, and as a result of this investigation conducted by Gates and I think James Schlesinger, they are going to upgrade the way the Air Force monitors its nuclear weapon systems. But, you know, unless we get rid of these hydrogen bombs, this is always going to be a problem, is it not?
Well, yeah, this is a real problem. In this particular situation where they transported these nuclear weapons by aircraft, and I think it was actually, I don't recall exactly what went to, I think it went to Taiwan by accident. I think there were fuses for nuclear weapons, not the actual nuclear weapons, but sensitive technology related to nuclear weapons. Mm. There is a lackadaisical attitude that's clear. I mean, this couldn't possibly happen if the attitudes of people or the organization was not, in one way or other, not paying attention to safety and security. I might add that there are a lot of people who are very concerned about the potential for nuclear weapons somehow being lost or stolen from Russia. But this example shows that maybe the United States should be worried about its own military operations in this area.
Yeah.
And it's just hard to believe that people could handle these weapons so cavalierly. But it's pretty clear that it's pretty clear they did, and I think the Secretary of Defense Gates did exactly the right thing. He fired the chief of staff of the Air Force, and he also fired the secretary of the Air Force. And I think it's a very good thing that a secretary of defense fires people when they're caught not doing their job. I think we have a problem in this country that there's kind of a dual standard with regard to high-level people in the Pentagon, and in fact other government positions as well, when they do things that are that reckless and or that negligent, they should be fired. And I applaud Secretary Gates for doing that.
Yes, well, having vaguely covered then the issue of accidental annihilation via nuclear war, and I just would say at this point of the 30,000 nuclear weapons in the world or so. Russia and America still currently own about 97% of them. So really, the biggest nuclear nations in the world that hold the world at ransom really are Russia and America. But let's move on then to your area of expertise, Dr. Postel, which is missile defense. The United States would say that it's placing 10 missile defense interceptors in Poland and an X-band radar in Czechoslovakia because they're worried that Iran might get a missile and arm it with a nuclear weapon. It has neither. And that's to protect, I think, Europe against Iran. But the truth is, I think, and you've written about this, it's really about Russia, is it not? And if there is a nuclear, quotes, exchange between Russia and America, and Russia, America doesn't knock off all its missiles before they launch, and a few get launched, that these missile defense bases and equipment are really being set up for Russian missiles to intercept them, not Iranian missiles. Would that be true?
Well, it's always there's always some level of ambiguity associated with any military deployment. But I would say that if you look at where the United States chose to place the different components, it certainly looks like the system was carefully optimized to be able to engage Russian ICBMs that would be launched toward the United States if there was, an attack from either the United States against Russia or vice versa. So it does have the appearance of the locations of the launch site in Poland and the Czech Republic for the radar. The location of the radar is important because the radar could, in principle, currently the radar has no capability, but in principle, when they put a radar in that has capability, it could see Russian ICBMs early enough in powered flight that interceptors launched from Poland could potentially intercept them. Now, This deployment of the United States has got so many peculiar and inconsistent characteristics that it's almost hard to know how to talk about it. Let me give you an example. If you look at the characteristics of the radar that the United States has negotiated with the Czech Republic. To put in the Czech Republic, the radar will not be able to perform the functions that the Missile Defense Agency claims it will be doing. It doesn't have the power and antenna size needed to be able to do that, looking for warheads.
Mm.
So it's literally useless in the central role that the Missile Defense Agency claims for it. We looked at this very carefully, and we were stunned as we analyzed this further. And we finally concluded that the purpose of the radar is simply to create a political fact on the ground. In other words, they're trying to put this radar in, negotiate a treaty, create an installation that would spend a lot of money in the Czech Republic, so build public support for keeping it there. And then maybe 5 or 10 years from now, you would literally bulldoze this radar down and replace it with a radar that could actually do the job, because the current radar has no chance of functioning.
Well, why would they put in such an insignificant radar in the first place? I don't understand.
Because they can't build, they don't have enough of their, this radar is built from hundreds of thousands of tiny transmit-receive, what are called modules, that have to be put into the antenna face of the radar.
Mm.
And the United States has not been able to manufacture these transmit-receive modules at nearly the rate it needs to be able to build the large enough radars to do the job. So what it looks like they're doing is they're putting in a radar that has no capability to create a fact on the ground.
Mm.
In other words, by negotiating a treaty with the Czech Republic, politicians in the Czech Republic have committed themselves to allowing a base. The United States has committed itself to having a base. The United States has given the Czech Republic special status through the treaty. They've given them military equipment. So now the next president decides maybe that this is crazy. Well, the next president has to withdraw from a treaty arrangement, and or at least not deploy something that was negotiated at some considerable political cost for the United States. So the idea is to make it difficult for the next president to change directions. So it's a political act, a very cynical political act.
I'm talking now with Dr. Ted Postol, the Professor of Science, Technology and National Security Policy in the Program in Science, Technology and Society at MIT. And this is If You Love This Planet. Well, as you talk, Dr. Postol, we just go round and round in circles, I guess, and any logical person would say, what on earth do they think they're doing? This is very provocative towards Russia, which is Russia's getting very upset about these installations in Poland and Czechoslovakia. We can count the angels on the head of a pin sort of thing and analyze the details, but the broad picture looks irrational, doesn't it, really?
Oh, I think it's quite irrational, and it's worse than irrational. It's very dangerous. And it's creating dangers where there's no need to create a danger. There are lots of things we have to deal with, this global we, that pose potential dangers to civilization. And we need to properly identify things we need to concentrate on. And this is something that's totally artificial and, in fact, is an enormous danger and really doesn't bring any additional security to anybody, United States, Russia, or other countries around the globe.
Yeah. Now, I'd like to get into the various phases of missile defense: boost phase, transition, transit phase, terminal phase, and the like, but we don't have time to go into that. But there's something else I really wanted to talk to you about, Dr. Postol. You work at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and associated with that organization or academic institution is Lincoln Labs, which actually are part of MIT, who've been involved in the testing of missile defense. You have been involved in some significant areas where you have been taking on the powers that be on various missile defense testing, and you've now brought in the Congress, I think. Would you like to give us a brief history of the last 7 years of what's actually been happening?
Well, what basically happened is MIT operates Lincoln Laboratory. In fact, it's MIT Lincoln Laboratory. And this is a large laboratory. It does ballistic missile defense research along with other research. And it's run by the Department of Defense. It's actually an Air Force laboratory. And it was involved in examining a very early but key experiment in the missile defense program where they tried the missile defense system people tried to test whether they could see the difference between warheads and decoys, because one of the big problems, as I mentioned earlier, is being able to tell the difference between warheads and decoys. And they flew a test vehicle, and the test vehicle had a failure. It was an engineering failure, and it basically failed to collect any scientifically usable information. In spite of this, they misrepresented this experiment as a success. And they even briefed the Congress by telling them that the experiment was a success, when in fact, it was a total failure.
So they, in other words, they cooked the data.
Yeah, they didn't have any data to cook. But
They made up the data.
They cooked the analysis of phony data, is what they did.
Right.
They had no data.
Right.
And and I called this to the attention. I found out about this through another series of accidents that were outside of MIT. And I thought the fraud was actually due to another organization, but I later found out MIT Lincoln Laboratory was the perpetrator of the fraud.
Right.
And I brought this to the attention of MIT's then president, Charles Best, who now, I might add, is currently president of the National Academy of Engineering. And basically, MIT went into what I would call cover-up mode. And they have tried to cover up the fact that they misrepresented this experiment, that they lied to the Congress. And we went through a long process where MIT, the administration of MIT, which has oversight responsibility for this military laboratory, made many false statements in its attempt to basically impede a federally mandated investigation. For example, MIT claimed that an internal inquiry MIT had done, which found clear evidence of fraud, had been classified, which is incidentally a violation of the regulations on classification of national security information. So they falsely claimed an internal inquiry had not, couldn't be talked about, when in fact we now know, because it was declassified last year, that the MIT internal inquiry 6 years ago found evidence for fraud at MIT Lincoln Laboratory. So it's a pretty serious situation because it is MIT, and I'm not only a professor at MIT, I'm a three-time graduate of MIT, and I don't like being associated with a war profiteer, and that's what MIT has been behaving like in this situation. So I've been working hard to get this exposed.
Okay, explain then exactly how, Dr. Postel, you see MIT behaving as a war profiteer in this situation. How does it profit by producing fraudulent data on a missile defense test?
Oh, there's a very interesting high incentive MIT has.
Yeah.
This is not well known even in the Congress, although I've been telling people about it more recently. MIT has this sweetheart arrangement with the Department of Defense where MIT classifies MIT Lincoln Laboratory as an academic department of MIT. That is to say, Lincoln Laboratory, which has no faculty and basically is not on our campus and does military research, which is mostly classified, it is classified as an academic department by MIT. Now, the reason it's classified as an academic department is because this allows MIT to charge a very high overhead to the U.S. government. So this seems to be a sweetheart deal they worked out.
What do you mean an overhead? I don't understand that expression.
Well, for example, it looks like MIT gets about 6% on every dollar spent at Lincoln Laboratory.
So by the Department of Defense.
Overall budget, $600 million.
Yeah.
So they get $36 million, which goes into their pocket for doing whatever they want.
Right.
Now, this arrangement is a fundamental conflict of interest because MIT is supposed to be performing a management and oversight function for Lincoln Laboratory.
Mm.
Now, if you're overseeing Lincoln Laboratory and you find evidence of fraud and you address the evidence of fraud, you may lose funding for a program because it's fraudulent.
Mm.
Well, that means that exercising your oversight function causes you to lose revenue.
I see.
So you have a fundamental conflict of interest. And this is the situation at MIT. And in fact, I have been ordered in a confidential letter from the president of MIT not to talk about this as I'm talking to you about it. They claim that the president claims that they investigated themselves. MIT investigated itself. It found that it's done nothing wrong and it's doing wonderfully. And hence, I violate MIT's policies and procedures by raising these questions about MIT's integrity in a public forum. And of course, my response to this is I didn't give up my First Amendment rights to be a professor at MIT. You know, it's a kind of a bizarre argument they put together.
Now, you've approached some congressional committees or congresspeople.
I'm talking
about
to some people in the Congress. Right now, I'd rather not say too much detail.
Yeah.
Just because people may or may not choose to take action, and you know, although I don't agree with such decisions, it's really they're the politicians, not me. But there are people definitely listening and looking into this now.
Do you have colleagues, Dr. Postle, at MIT, who support your stand and are backing you up?
Yeah, I certainly do have colleagues that support my stand. But the administration at MIT is pretty thuggish.
Thuggish.
And they, you know, they've threatened me repeatedly. And now, of course, they have to take action. And obviously, I'm defying them.
Mm.
And they do have to worry that I'm tenured. And if they want to try to act on my tenure contract, they're going to have to prove misconduct. And I don't think they can make these threats that they have. You know, if it really becomes push comes to shove, we're going to wind up in front of the Supreme Court.
Mm.
And even with this Supreme Court, they're going to be on the wrong end of a decision.
Yeah.
So I think it's very unfortunate that the MIT Corporation would behave like such a group of war profiteers, because they are misrepresenting. Let's forget about whether or not we think missile defense is good or bad. They are representing a weapon system that they know cannot work as something that will work. Doesn't matter at this point whether you think it's a good idea or not. Just think the seriousness of this kind of behavior.
Yes.
I mean, we could argue about any weapon system, whether it's, you know, beneficial or not. It can be a truly defensive system or whatever. But to lie, to knowingly misrepresent the capabilities of a weapon system to your government, is to me incredibly unethical.
Mm.
And that's what's going on here.
Well, I must say that I really, really respect you, Dr. Postle, for the stand that you've taken. You've been very courageous, and I think that knowing you, you could not have done anything else. And
that's true. I had no choice.
You had no choice. And people like you who stand up for what is right and moral are the people who really lead the world towards sanity and survival. And I acknowledge you and appreciate so much what you're doing, and will support you. Of course, I probably can't, but in any way I possibly could. And I hope people listening to this program will support Dr. Postle too. Do you have a web page where people can go and get more information, A, about you, B, about the material that you've written, the articles and the like?
Yeah, there's a web page. You know, unfortunately, I don't remember it.
Ah.
But if you go to www.mit.edu,
yeah,
and you look for the Science, Technology, and Society Global Security Working Group, you'll find us. There's a Google search
Good.
Function.
And
the
literature you've produced and the like.
Yes.
Well, we've reached the end of our time, and I want to thank you enormously for coming on and explaining some rather arcane technological details to our audience, so now they may have a little better idea of the type of world in which they live so that they can do something about it to make the world safer for ourselves and the future?
Well, all I can do is do my best, and that's all I'm trying to do.
Thank you very much, Dr. Postel.
You're very welcome.
Today I've been speaking with Dr. Ted Postel, Professor of Science, Technology and National Security Policy in the program in Science, Technology and Society at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. In 1983, I met with President Ronald Reagan in the White House and spent an hour and a quarter talking with him about all aspects of the nuclear arms race. What I was not to know was that shortly thereafter, he announced a program called, euphemistically, Star Wars, which was about missile defense. The fact that the movement had gathered 1 million people in Central Park means that we were about to beat and defeat the military-industrial complex and end the nuclear arms race. So the military-industrial complex didn't end run around us. Edward Teller and some people within the Reagan administration convinced him that Star Wars would be a good idea. He saw it as a sort of big yellow plastic shield over America where the Russian missiles bounced off and everyone in America was safe. It was known at the time and then shortly thereafter that this anti-missile shield would never work, would never protect America against a missile, a nuclear attack against America by Russia. However, since that time, 1984, where he announced the program, over $100 billion have been spent on a useless program, much of it going into universities, doing the research, and paying professors and researchers to work on this useless program. It is also very provocative because although China's only got 20 missiles that can hit America, it could be impelled to build more if America sets up a missile defense system. Russia, which has got 2,500 H-bombs that can land on America within half an hour, they are very threatened by the missile defense system, although they too know it will not work. So the only way to bypass it is to build thousands more hydrogen bombs. So it's extremely provocative, extremely dangerous. We know it won't work from Ted Postel's discussion that you've just heard. Now, some people think that President Obama will end the race for missile defense. But recently there was an article in Time magazine where people within the program talk about defense programs achieving what people call the escape velocity, that synergy of speed and gravity that lets a vehicle soar smoothly into the skies. And some people say that so much money and time and effort and research has been spent on Star Wars that it will be kept going. If Obama chooses Robert Gates to be defense secretary, he is in support of it. There's another leading contender called Richard Danzig, a Clinton Navy secretary who is in support of it. Obama has said that he won't deploy missile defense if it doesn't work, but who knows what's going to happen? French President Nicolas Sarkozy warned Washington against deploying the shield in Europe, and they want to put the elements of this missile defense in Poland and Czechoslovakia, which is extremely provocative to the Russians. And President Dmitry Medvedev has said that it would complicate things and make the move backward. In other words, Russia would build more nuclear weapons. The outgoing general who heads the Pentagon's missile defense efforts says the system is absolutely workable, which is an absolute lie, after you've heard what Ted Postel talked about, the leading physicist who understands these systems. Lieutenant General Henry Obering, who's leaving the post of heading the Pentagon's missile shield or defense efforts after 4 years, says US interests would be severely hurt if Obama abandons the Bush administration's plans to expand the missile shield to Europe. What we have discovered is that a lot of the folks that have not been in the Bush administration seem to be dated in terms of the program Obering said. He said they're kind of calibrated back in the 2000 time frame, and we've come a hell of a long way since 2000, which is also a lie. Now, there's recent groundbreaking in a place about 10 miles south of the Pentagon at the Headquarters Command Center at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, the command center for missile defense. And they're about to build a $38.5 million building, which will be home to 300 missile defense agency workers. Its planned brick veneer will match the Fort Georgian Colonial Revival style. Once finished in late 2010, the brand new missile defense headquarters will blend in with Fort Belvoir's pre-World War II buildings. It will seem like it's always been there. So let's hope and pray that President Obama has the courage, tenacity, perseverance, and vision to cancel once and for all this crazy, provocative, dangerous missile defense scheme that President Reagan, in his, well, was he innocent? No. In his way off the track understanding of anything nuclear, initiated and put into place. That's the show for today. If you'd like to learn more, and you'd like to help contribute to keeping this show on the road, on the air, paying for our wonderful producer, Jasmine Williams, who works with me in Australia, Amanda Bellaby and Scott Powell, who do their work in the United States to support this program. This is Helen Caldicott from If You Love This Planet, signing off. Thanks for joining us on this really fascinating topic of missile defense and the risk of accidental nuclear war and fraud at MIT. So thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
I was born with my food firmly planted in my mouth. I was born with my hands. No roof is falling. No tides are coming down. Oh, I've been waiting in the hope you'll come around. No roof is falling. No tides are coming down. Still I'm
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.